Did you know that you can be a critically thinking, rational person and be a Christian? Did you know that there's good evidence that Christianity is true? Did you know that the Christian faith can withstand the toughest of scrutiny? Welcome to the Cerebral Faith Podcast, where we believe because of the brains God gave us and not in spite of them. I'm your host, Evan Minton. Welcome to Cerebral Faith Live. I'm Evan Minton. Today we're going to be talking about my study habits. This topic was proposed to me by Ken Samples last week. If you remember, I had Ken Samples on the podcast to talk about pursuing the life of the mind, and how Christians are not really pursuing the life of the mind. They're letting their minds go to waste. If they read at all, it's mostly just secular self-help books. They don't spend time in the Bible. They don't spend time in theology or reading anything with any particular amount of substance. And that's what Professor Samples and I talked about last week. And in the context of that, he suggested on the show that I do an episode talking about my study habits, like how I have come to learn all that I currently know. And sorry, I'm trying to adjust the camera so that you don't get a whole bunch of overhead light in, and also a messy background. I would have cleaned up all of that back there, but I thought I had more time. I thought it was like 7 o'clock. It was 8, and so I just didn't have time to do any of that. Those of you listening on the audio podcast later won't know what I'm talking about. But this is a live web show on YouTube as well as an audio podcast. And those of you listening on Spotify don't have to see my ugly, unkempt bed. Anyway, I have this StreamYard logo up because tonight it's not really a presentation. That means if anybody shows up live, which I hope they will, I would have more confidence that they will if this were a Monday night, but I can't do Monday nights anymore. I work second shift almost always on a Monday. I have like different banners here on Cerebral Faith Live for like different kinds of content. I have Cerebral Faith Live debates here. So if I have a debater, like several weeks ago, I had Aaron Yilmaz and Fuzz Rana of Reasons to Believe. They were talking about whether or not evolution is true. From a scientific standpoint, Aaron Yilmaz was giving arguments for evolution, and Fuzz Rana was giving scientific arguments against evolution. And I also used this banner while hosting a debate between James Fedor and Caleb Jackson on the historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. And then I've got this right here, which I use when I'm giving a PowerPoint presentation, which is most of my Cerebral Faith Live episodes. And then I have this for when I'm interviewing a guest. But since none of those are applicable, we're just going to have the duck who James Gadomski, or Barely Protestant, said last week was bae. The duck is bae. So before we get started, if you want to support this ministry financially, go to patreon.com/cerebralfaith. And if you'd like to check out more apologetics and theology content, go to www.cerebralfaith.net. And for those of you watching this or listening to this podcast, watching it on YouTube, like the video and subscribe. For those of you who are listening, if you're listening on iTunes, leave a positive review because that helps podcasts get more attention. So my study habits, how do I approach reading and learning? This is basically what I'm going to be talking about tonight is not so much going to be like universal rules that I think everyone ought to do. Everyone is different. Everyone learns different. Everyone learns differently. Everyone has different brains that are wired differently, and you might, what is good for me might not be good for you. And the way that I approach studying and learning theology and apologetics and philosophy and all, and just things in general, that may not be right for you. But I do think some of the things I do might be helpful universally, some of them are just like peculiar to me. This is just the way that I do things. And if you wanted to try to implement this yourself, you're free to try that or modify it according to, you know, your schedule and also, you know, the way you learn things. We all learn things differently. That's one of the things that I think is wrong with the public education system, is that it expects everyone to learn everything in exactly the same way, whereas human beings don't work like that. And I think about the Albert Einstein quote, and especially a cartoon that was drawn above the quote that said, if you judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree, it will live its life forever thinking that it's stupid. Everybody learns things different ways. So if it's not, it may be right for me, but it may not be right for you. And what's right for you may not be right for me. So if you've read Inference to the One True God, or the updated version to that, The Case for the One True God, my book, or if you've listened to like the first episode of the Cerebral Faith audio podcasts, or and I think I've talked about it on this channel, how I got into Christian apologetics. I've told this, you know, the story so many times in so many places. Those who have followed the ministry are bound to have read it or heard it out of me somewhere. But when I was 18, I wanted to share my faith with other people. And so I started to share my faith with everyone. And online, I started to talk about Jesus, the gospel, what he did on the cross for us. And I started, you know, getting these very combative atheists coming at me. And they were mean and nasty and vile, and they bombarded me with objections to Christianity and a whole bunch of different questions that I didn't know how to answer. Questions that would be elementary for me now in answering easily. In fact, I've probably written an article on just about every single one that was proposed to me back then, in all likelihood. I was like, well, I can't really answer any of these questions. So it was a 4th of July celebration. I had to get off the computer and, you know, go do the festivities with my family. So I put it out of my mind for a little while, and then just, you know, went to a local event that was being thrown. But the next day I started thinking about that conversation. And as I started thinking about it, doubt started to fill my mind. You know, one of the questions that was, you believe gods like Zeus and Thor and Aphrodite and what's another polytheistic god? Loki. You think that these are myths, but you don't believe Yahweh is a myth. Why do you regard all these other gods as mythological, made up, make believe? Legends, but you don't believe that with the God of Christianity. That was really the thing that bothered me the most. It wasn't so much something like the problem of evil or any alleged Bible contradictions. It was basically, I don't know why Christianity is true. Now, I had a very powerful experience with God. I had an experience that I will never forget, and I told this atheist I was trying to witness to about my experience. But he dismissed it as being like neurological, stuff happening in my brains, firing neurons, bubbling chemicals, things that I needed. And he said something like, this was like 11 years ago, but I think he said something like, well, this is a purely psychological phenomenon. You like brought it on yourself because you needed it to happen during this very dark period in your life. And so like I didn't even have my own personal testimony to stand on anymore. I had no epistemological ground. It had been swept out from under me because it could have been a purely psychological, neurological explanation for all I knew. And so it just haunted me for days that maybe Christianity really is like Greek mythology or Roman mythology. Maybe it was just made up by a group of, as the internet atheists would say, Bronze Age goat herders. And there really is nothing to it. Maybe it is just a, the Bible, maybe it is just a book of fairy tales. Well, I knew that if God exists, if Christianity were true, God would obviously not, for me to become an agnostic, which is where I was sliding. He wouldn't want that because 2 Peter 3:9 says God is not willing that any should perish, but wants all people to come to repentance. 1 Timothy 2:4 says God wants all people to be saved and to come to a knowledge of the truth. And so I'm like, okay, well, if God exists, then he will help me to keep believing somehow. He will show me his reality. And so I prayed about it. And initially, I think I got strengthened by what philosophers William Lane Craig and Malvin Plantinga would call the inner witness of the Holy Spirit. But then I got some good, solid evidential grounds because I discovered Lee Strobel's movie, The Case for a Creator. This was like the first year I was on Facebook, and somebody posted a link to Lee Strobel's film, The Case for a Creator, on YouTube. It was on the link was on Facebook, but the link took me to YouTube, and I watched it, and I was just blown away. Now, those of you who, again, those of you who have followed this ministry for any length of time will know that I'm a theistic evolutionist. I'm an evolutionary creationist. I prefer that term bet more than theistic evolutionist because evolutionary creationist puts the emphasis on creation rather than evolution, whereas theistic evolution sounds like I'm an evolutionist who just happens to be a theist. And so I don't really regard all of the arguments in that film to be sound anymore. There are some I still think are good, the Kalam cosmological argument and the cosmic and local fine-tuning argument, but irreducible complexity is kind of sketchy. The DNA argument, not, but still, I was blown away by especially the argument from the origin of and fine-tuning of the universe, and I still am. And I'm like, wow, these are philosophers and scientists who are presenting real solid reasons to believe that there is a creator. That led me to buy Lee Strobel's book, the book based on that the movie was based on, The Case for Creator. And I read The Case for Christ, which says that the subtitle was A Journalist Investigates the Historical Evidence for Christ or something like that. I don't really remember the subtitle. I just know the title, The Case for Christ. And I, again, blown away by all of the evidence for the reliability of the New Testament, the evidence for Jesus's postmortem appearances and empty tomb, and I was especially stunned that there was even extra biblical mentions of Jesus. I knew that there were mentions of Jesus in things like the Talmud, but I had never heard of Josephus or Tacitus or Maribar Serapion before I read that Lee Strobel's interview with what was his name? Edwin Yamaguchi, I think it was. And so I was off and running. That was my entryway into the world of Christian apologetics, and I would soon find that myself going down a rabbit hole that goes deeper and deeper and deeper and into biblical studies and philosophy. So that's my story. That's how I started. Now, how did I how did I approach mastering these subjects well enough to talk about them to where how did I get to the point where I'm like, okay, I'm going to start a blog and then a podcast and now a YouTube channel that I know enough and I have enough resources and I have a big enough bibliography where I think I can speak with some authority on these issues. Well, not my own authority because I'm a well-read layman, but I link to people who have PhDs in these fields who say, hey, this is my argument. This is my logic. These are my premises. And here's a whole bunch of guys who agree with me for exactly the same reasons. And if I talk about like the original Hebrew or Greek, I'll reference a lexicon or a commentary. I stand on other people's credentials. But how did I guess what I'm saying is I got to a point where I'm like, yes, I can talk about this because I know a lot about it. I've read, I'm not just, I don't just have surface level knowledge of, say, the cosmological argument or the debate on how to interpret Genesis. So I wish I had prepared a PowerPoint slide. That would have been nice, but it's been a busy week, and yeah, but hopefully you can just make, maybe a PowerPoint slide in your mind's eye. So first, none of these things is what I started out doing. It's just kind of what I fell into, and then I just kind of stumbled into these study habits, and I eventually found, oh, hey, some of these ways of approaching things work better than others. First thing I do is, well, when I first started studying apologetics, I jumped around a lot, but not really. I did kind of narrow in on arguments for God's existence, the reliability of the New Testament, and the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. And of course, how to respond to the problem of evil. Just general apologetics. I read a whole bunch of books on that. I read William Lane Craig's On Guard, Defending Your Faith with Reason and Precision. Excellent introductory apologetics book. I recommend anybody who is new to apologetics and wants to learn how to defend their faith, get that book, On Guard, Defending Your Faith with Reason and Precision. I read Lee Strobel's The Case for Christ, The Case for Faith, The Case for the Real Jesus, The Case for a Creator. I read Frank Turek and Norman Geisler's I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. I read Neil Mammen's Who is Agent X? Proving that Science and Logic Show that It's More Rational to Believe God Exists. That's a small book, and if you, I find that it's really accessible and the arguments are pretty strong. It's basically one big argument defending the cause. It's basically one big book defending the Kalam cosmological argument, but he talks about fine-tuning as well. His name is Neil Mammen. You can get the book at noblindfaith.com, and you can also get it on Amazon. I read that book. Read Doug Palman. Palman, not Palman. I read Palman's The Holman Quick Source Guide to Christian Apologetics. I've got some of these books on my shelf here. Yeah, this one. That's one of the that's the Doug Powell. It's not Powell Palman, it's Powell. So yeah, I did kind of jump around, but not really. I was kind of narrowed into, arguments for God's existence and the reliability of the Bible. And I read for about an hour a day. I would read maybe one chapter of a book per day. But in 2015, I discovered a really, really effective method, and that is to drill down on one subject, and only one subject, and just run that into the ground. There was a Christian blogger who sort of ran a YouTube channel for a while and then kind of took it down. He had me, fortunately, he sent me the videos of the debates I participated in so I could put them up on my website. But I had some prep time. I actually did debate. I think he was an atheist, maybe an agnostic, named Nathan Rees on the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. And I was going to debate an atheist on the Kalam and fine-tuning arguments, but we just could never get around. We just couldn't get around to doing it, and eventually we just canceled it altogether. But I did do a lot of prep work for that. So in that month of April, I just read books on the resurrection of Jesus and the arguments for it. I read The Case for Christ. I read The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus by Gary Habermas and Michael Lycona. I read The Historical Jesus by Gary Habermas. I read How God Became Jesus by Michael Bird and a whole bunch of other contributors. But mostly I focused on, and this is something that is a study habit for me, is reading books over and over and over again to really remember the content and memorize it and internalize it. And the book that I read over and over and over again was The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus by Gary Habermas and Michael Lycona. I read this book multiple times. Throughout that month, and the wear and tear that you see on this book mostly came from reading it back to back to back to back to back to back to back during that month. And this book in particular comes with a interactive CD game where you can test your knowledge. It will quiz you on what you know, how much that you remember. So that was really helpful. And eventually I started off getting like 70% score, and I kept reading this until I was able to get 100% three times in a row. And so I prepped really hard for that debate with Nathan Rees, and I thought I did a pretty good job of it. And then the next debate that this YouTuber wanted me, you know, this blogger, he mostly ran a blog. He kind of ran a YouTube channel for a little while, but didn't really, he didn't really put much effort into it, and eventually he deleted it. The next debate was going to be with an atheist named, well, he didn't really want his real name public. That was kind of odd, but I'm just going to call him Anthony. We were going to do debate on the Kalam and fine-tuning arguments. And so I read like William Lane Craig's On Guard back to back to back to back to back. I read The Case for a Creator. I read God's Crime Scene by J. Warner Wallace. I think it had come out by then. I'm pretty sure I did. I read Hugh Ross's book, The Creator and the Cosmos, multiple times. I read Why the Universe is the Way It Is by Hugh Ross. I read, I read Reasonable Faith by William Lane Craig. That's like, you know, intermediate, whereas En Garde is more beginner level. And I had, you know, in this room, this very room, I had like large stacks of books about the, you know, Kalam and fine-tuning arguments, or books that contained chapters about those subjects. I really drilled down heavily on those, prepping for my debate, prepping for any possible response that my opponent might give me. And as a result, I mean, I knew how to defend the Kalam and cosmic and local fine-tuning arguments before that, but my ability to articulate them and defend them skyrocketed. I mean, it's kind of like a roller coaster. It's like I was learning and learning and learning. And then in 2015, when I decided to just only study that and really, really drill down hard on it, it was like, whew. And I became, because some of these books talked about like the moral argument and the ontological argument, such as William Lane Craig's Reasonable Faith. Oh, I also took his Defenders class on reasonablefaith.org. The existence of God section. I listened to those lectures. I became very skilled at defending those arguments too. Better than I ever was. And so by 2016, I'm like, why don't I just compile everything that I've learned into a book that became Inference to the One True God? I published it in 2016. But then I revamped it and republished it in 2019 because I thought, you know what, there's no chapter on the problem of evil in here. There should be a chapter on the problem of evil. I also had some new arguments, you know, I thought, you know, I could talk about some more examples of fine tuning. I could probably address more objections to the Kalam cosmological argument. And of course, I didn't like the title because now I hold to the Divine Council worldview. I don't think that gods like Baal and Molech are myths. I think that they are real gods with a lowercase g. They are the gods who are facing judgment in Psalm 82. You can see my live stream on Genesis 10 to 11 for more on that. You can also see, read a blog post of mine called "What is the Divine Council? And is it biblical?" So why I believe in Jesus instead of other gods? Well, these other gods are real. They are the sons of God that Psalm 82 talks about. I said, "You are God, sons of the Most High, all of you. Nevertheless, like men, you will die and fall as any prince." And Deuteronomy 32, 8 to 9, when the Most High divided up the nations and he fixed their portions, allotted their number according to the number of the sons of God, but Jacob, his allotted inheritance, he has reserved for himself. And Deuteronomy chapter 32, verses 8 to 9 references back to Genesis 11. So I'm like, why don't I rename it? I'm revamping it anyway. Why don't I just give it a new name? The Case for the One True God, a scientific, philosophical, and historical case for the God of Christianity. Pretty much the same book. Second edition, updated material, new name to reflect my Divine Council worldview self. And I also changed a paragraph where I said that I disagreed with evolution, but wasn't going to talk about it. I said, yeah, I don't think it's right, but it's not going to affect these arguments. That's what I said in the first edition. So two things I did in 2015. Number one, I decided to focus on only one topic, and I just ran with it. Secondly, I read way more than just one chapter a day. I was reading for like 3 to 4 hours a day, 3 or 4 hours in the evening or 3 or 4 hours in the morning, whenever time would permit me, or whenever I had free time, I would spend that time just binge reading all my books, getting as much read as possible. And I still do that. I still read as much as I can for as much time as I'm allotted. So a book like this, I can get through a 300-page book in about 2 or 3 days. So that's something I do. Now, I said that I read books over and over and over and over and over again. That's something I do because repetition, for me, is the best way to learn something. If I read a book on something I've never learned anything about before, I will remember some things like this. This is a book I've only read once. I'm going to read it again because I'm preparing a series on the Sermon on the Mount. And like I may remember like bits and pieces, or I may remember the overall premise or the overall, I may just get the gist of it, but I'm not going to remember the details, which may be important for recollection in a debate or a conversation. So it really helps to read a book over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. Now, if it's on a topic I'm already very familiar with, then I don't necessarily have to read that book multiple times. Like Philosophical Foundations for a Christian Worldview by William Lane Craig and J.P. Moreland. By the time I read that, I was already pretty well versed on that, on those subjects. That isn't to say I won't read it again. I will whenever I get around to it, but I don't really have to read it like 20 times. I can read it maybe 2 or 3, and that will be sufficient. So I can read a larger number of books on any given topic. I only have to read it like maybe once, twice, or maybe a third time if it's just a good book. So I did that with, I think I've read Michael Heiser's book, The Unseen Realm, 3 times. I've read John Walton's The Lost World of Genesis 1, probably 6 or 7 times. I've read John Walton's The Lost World of Adam and Eve several times. I've read Genesis 1 and Ancient Cosmology, the more academic version of The Lost World of Genesis 1. I think I've read that once or twice. That's just something I do. Read something. So I'm going to use my fingers because I don't have a PowerPoint slide. So number one is find a subject you want to learn about and focus only on that. Read everything on that subject until you are completely satisfied or bored with it. until you're like, yes, I've read like 30 books on whatever. I've read 30 books on X, or I've read 200 books on X from like 50 different authors or whatever, from a whole bunch of different perspectives, and so I'm satisfied. I'm going to move on to something else now. I have run natural theology into the ground. I've run the case for the resurrection into the ground. Now let's focus on the Arminian Calvinism debate, or let's focus on hell, eternal torment versus annihilation versus universalism, or you know, whatever. What that's kind of the order I went in. But like I said, when I first got started, I was just kind of all over the place, general apologetics. Whereas now, or really ever since 2015, it's more special, like focus on this, then focus on this, and then focus on this. And run these topics, and you can always revisit these topics. Like, I'm going to revisit the topic of the resurrection of Jesus when Gary Habermas releases his multi-volume magnum opus. Like, it's not like I'm not going to read that. I am. So you can revisit these topics later, and it's often helpful to do that, either to refresh your memory on some of the concepts, or maybe a new person has come out with a new book that's got new data, new arguments, or, you know, and you may even change your mind on some things. I've changed my mind on lots of things. So first, focus on one topic only. Secondly, this is what I do. Read for hours. You will get through more books faster if you do it that way. And thirdly, if you're brand spanking new to the subject, get a few books on it and read those books multiple times. This is what I do. Now, you may have like a really good memory, so you may only have to read this book or this book or whatever book. You may only have to read it maybe once and you've like memorized 99% of it. Maybe you have like a photographic memory or something. Again, these are just like rules for me. They may work for you. They may not work for you. They may not be necessary, or they may not be feasible. But again, the name of this podcast episode is called Evan Minton's Study Habits, not study habits that everyone everywhere has to do. Another thing that I do is I get the information fed through me visually as well as audibly. So I used to be a paperback hardcover guy. I have a whole bunch of books on my shelf that I bought at conferences or got for my birthday or Christmas or ordered off of Amazon or wherever. I got a whole bunch of different books that I got from a whole bunch of different occasions in paperback and hard copy. And what I did back then was I would read aloud to myself. I would read alone and I would read aloud. That way I was seeing the words on the page, but I was also hearing them. I was hearing the sound of my own voice. Now I'm an ebook, digital book guy, and there are reasons. There's a whole bunch of reasons for that. I'm not going to get into all of the reasons why I prefer ebooks, digital books now, over physical books. But the one reason that's pertinent to this episode's topic is that I don't have to read aloud to myself anymore to get that visual audio combo. I can activate text to speech, or I can get an audiobook and play the audiobook while I'm reading the ebook. And with Kindle books, Amazon, not all of them, but for a lot of books, if there's an audiobook available, if you buy the Kindle book, you can get the audiobook at a discount price. So let's say there's a $10 Kindle book on church history or soteriology, and there's an audiobook that goes with it. If you buy the audiobook, it might cost you $20 on its own if you were to just buy it separately. But if you buy the Kindle book, then the audiobook may be $7.49, like more than half off. That's really helpful. And when you open your Kindle app on your phone, as the audiobook plays, it will highlight the words that the narrator, the reader, is saying. That's really helpful, especially since now I read for like 2-3, sometimes even 4 hours at a time. And when you're reading aloud, like, that's 4 hours of just talking. That can get very tiresome on the vocal cords for a while. But if I'm playing text to speech or, you know, a robot voice, or if I'm playing an audiobook along with it, that's a lot easier. And so rather than read aloud, I just listen to the audiobook while I read along with the words in the ebook document, or I play text to speech. With Kindle, most of the time, if I don't have an audiobook, a certain digital assistant whose name I dare not say lest she activate. Alexa. Oh, she heard me. She will read it. And she's got a pretty realistically human-sounding voice for a digital assistant. It doesn't sound very robotic at all. It's actually quite pleasant to listen to. Or I can pull up the audiobook from Audible, and I can play that. Now I have Logos, and Logos has a built-in text-to-speech feature, and I've been playing that as I've been reading Dr. Martin Lloyd Jones's book Studies in the Sermon on the Mount. That has been a very good book. I really recommend it. Dr. Martin Lloyd Jones, he has the intellectual rigor of a theologian, but he has the rhetorical speaking skills of a preacher. So it's like you get the best of both worlds. Some preachers can't exegete their way out of a paper bag, and some people are really good theologians, but they don't really make good preachers. They don't have that rhetorical power. I think a preacher should have both. They should be good theologians, they should be able to exegete the text well, and they should have good speaking skills. And I think Dr. Martin Lloyd Jones meets both of those criteria. I have really enjoyed reading this book. Not to get off on a rabbit trail there, but I get the visual audio combination because I'm here sitting on my computer. I've got Logos pulled up. I've got Martin Lloyd Jones' book pulled up, and I play the text to speech, and it's kind of robotic, but I don't really mind that much. And if I like want to take a note, or if I want to highlight something that I've read using Logos's or Logos's note-taking feature, I'll just pause the text-to-speech feature, take my notes, and then resume. So that's something that helps me getting the information through more than one of my five senses. I mean, I'm seeing the words on the page, I'm hearing them. That helps a lot. Whereas if I was just reading silently, I probably wouldn't remember quite as much. Okay, what was I gonna say? I was gonna say something else and I totally forgot it. Logos. It had something to do with Logos. I don't know. Anyway, that's something that I do. Again, you don't have to do that. You can read all of your books silently, and maybe only once, if that works for you. But that's what works for me. That's what I've been doing. And I don't have to read like the same book nearly as many times if I do the visual audio combination. Like if I read the book silently, maybe it would be 10 times, but with those two factors, maybe it's only 5. Or, maybe it's 2 instead of 4. Oh, yeah. This is what I was going to say. If I could read Braille and I could get that, that would be a third sense that I could get it. So I could have like the visual text over here and I could be reading the Braille and I could be hearing it. Then I'd really be remembering what I read. I noticed the usefulness of visuals and audio when I watch documentaries on TV, like I love science programs. I love like Neil deGrasse Tyson. I'm probably one of the very few Christians on the face of the planet who likes Neil deGrasse Tyson's Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey. There's also this show called How the Universe Works. I don't know if it's still running, but it ran for like 4 seasons and it's got a whole bunch of CGI graphics and a whole bunch of scientists talking and explaining, you know, different things about, well, how the universe works, particularly in the realm of physics and astrophysics. And I really remember it when I've got all these visuals, all of the, in addition to these PhD scientists explaining things to me. That really sticks with me. And when I'm reading a book, I kind of try to do those visuals in my mind's eye. When I'm reading Hugh Ross's, the Creator and the Cosmos, I try to imagine nucleosynthesis happening inside the center of a star, or the radiation spreading throughout the cosmos. I kind of try to visualize it in my mind, my mind's eye, kind of like playing a movie in my mind's eye. That really helps to internalize it. What else could I say about study habits? I think that's pretty much it about how I go about learning things. Right now, with that thing I said about, you know, really drilling down on one subject. Well, right now I'm doing that with the Sermon on the Mount. I've read Matthew 5-7 multiple times, you know, in Logos, because Logos is really, really helpful. They're not sponsoring this stream, by the way. They're not sponsoring this podcast. With Logos, I have the Bible text on the left-hand side, and I have the commentary on the right-hand side, and I can link them up, and the two will scroll together. I absolutely love it. And because I have to stop and start, and I look up all of the biblical references that, say, R.T. France makes, it's not really practical to do the text-to-speech option in that case. But if it's like a theology book that I'm just straight reading through in Logos, then I'll turn on the text to speech. But I didn't do that when I was going through R.T. France's commentary and Stuart Webert's commentary, because it just wasn't practical to do it at that point. But I did read it aloud, and I took a whole bunch of notes. I have a notebook in Logos that's just all, you know, all these Sermon on the Mount notes that I'm going to read and compile, and there are some quotes I want to use in PowerPoint slides. And so that's what I'm focusing on now, because I would like to do a series here on Cerebral Faith Live about the Sermon on the Mount, because it's very important. It's our Lord's words. Maybe not verbatim. If New Testament scholars like Michael Icone are correct, they just like wanted to record the essence of what he said and not verbatim what he said. But I mean, it is our Lord's words. It's about the kingdom of God and how the inhabitants of the kingdom are to behave and live in this world. And there are some things in it that are commonly misunderstood and mispreached. Not everything, but some things people get very, very wrong. I was originally going to just start it out as a series of like 3 or 4 videos called Misunderstandings on the Mount. But then I'm like, why don't I just go whole hog and just do a whole series on it? But then I really feel like I should do my due diligence and if I'm going to do a whole series on it, then I need to do a whole lot more research, because I'm going to be covering a whole lot more ground. Maybe I have some misunderstandings on the Mount that need to be corrected. And so that got pushed out farther into the future than I originally planned. And they were going to be uploaded videos, but now they're going to be live stream presentations. And when I get done with this, there's one book in my bibliography about the primeval history that I want to read before I write a book on it, and that's William Lane Craig's On the Historical Adam. Would have read it back in November, but I burned out. And then I didn't read anything, I didn't make anything for a whole 6 months. So yeah, I still haven't read Craig's Adam book yet. But I'm gonna read, that's gonna be like one of the first things I read after I get done with the Sermon on the Mount series. So I've noticed I have a little eyeball up here in my StreamYard, dashboard that tells me how many people are watching live. There's only one person, and that sucks. And I only got two people. Actually, it wasn't last week, but it was the week before last. I had a terrible cold, so I had to preempt that. Only two people showed up when I had the interview with Ken Samples. I am working second shift at Dollar General now, and my hours are kind of unpredictable. And so I can't really have a set in stone date. I'm thinking I'm probably going to have to do these streams on a different night of the week, probably every week. Sometimes if I don't have to go in on Monday, I will do shoot for Monday, because I remember last summer when I did all these PowerPoint they were Google Slides and Canva, not PowerPoint. But I did all these slides, presentation, lectures. I got a whole bunch of people showing up when it was a Monday, but if I did it on a Saturday or a Tuesday, not so much. Monday night seemed to be the sweet spot. That seems to, time slot wise, that seems to be what works for most people. I want people to show up live for these, you know, the Cerebral Faith podcast / live web show on YouTube, because I like the interactive element. I'm sure you guys love the interactive element. I get to, you know, I have a Q&A session. You can talk to the scholars that I'm interviewing. You can ask questions for them yourself, and I can, you know, I show them up on screen like this. This is a sample comment. I will read it off and I'll respond to it. And I think it's just a lot better than having a pre-recorded podcast. I like it. I like talking to you guys, interacting with you guys, and you know, some of you pose really good questions, and it's great. But I'm gonna have to probably shift it around. So here's what, those of you watching on YouTube and those of you who want to tune in live, this is what I recommend you do. Subscribe and turn on notifications. If you turn on notifications, you won't have to worry, well, when is the next live stream going to be? When is the next Cerebral Faith Live going to be? Is it going to be on Saturday? Is it going to be on Monday, Wednesday? If you turn on notifications, then you won't have to worry about that. And also, if you follow the Cerebral Faith Facebook page, I will post them days in advance, telling you when to tune in. So yeah, that's what I recommend. So yeah, I think that's pretty much it. So I'm this is not a good time slot, obviously. not very many people tune in on Saturday nights. Most people are probably out doing stuff, especially now that we're not really in the height of the pandemic, although we might be in another one. I don't really know too much about this monkeypox thing that's been going around. I need to look into that a little bit more. I've heard conflicting information about it, but I hope that it's not anything that's going to shut the country down, because shut the world down like COVID did. That would be bad. I've got one comment here. I'm just going to read it off. You'll build your viewers back up. Do you think guys like John Walton take A&E parallels with the Bible too far? That's one of the main criticisms I've heard. I don't think so. I think there is, you'd have to hear the case for the, like, the cosmic temple view, the functional origins view, I think you'd have to hear it, and I don't have enough time to do that in this stream, but for those of you who want to know what Richard is talking about, I did a whole series on the on the primeval history last year. You can find it here on the channel. I did a whole presentation talking about the thesis of John Walton's book. I drew heavily from his book, quoted him a few times. I also added some of my own thoughts. I think John Walton, I think he downplays the polemical aspects of Genesis 1 a little bit too much. I don't think he focuses too much on that. My problem with Walton is really not that he goes, ironically, it's not that he goes too far. I don't think he goes far enough. I'm like, yes, it is about functional origins and not material origins. Yes, there is this temple motif, and other scholars like Ben Stanhope and J. Richard Middleton will be on board with that. But, they're also like shooting down the creation myths that were surrounding them. I think primarily what the author of Genesis has in view is, when they are taking pot shots, I think they're taking pot shots at the Enuma Elish and also the creation story with Baal. All through the Bible, the biblical authors are taking pot shots at Baal and Ugaritic religion, because Ugarit was just north of Israel, and you read the historical narratives in the Old Testament, the Israelites were going after Baal all the time. It was their favorite god to go a-whoring after, to use prophetic language. We see, like, Daniel 7 talks about the Son of Man coming on the cloud. Lots of places in the Old Testament talks about God making the clouds his chariot. And when you read the Baal text, it'll say that Baal is he's the cloud rider. He rides the clouds. He was the Canaanite or a storm deity. Yeah, it was the storm deity. Had a brain fart there for a second. I almost called him the crop deity. What? You see parallels, and first, are there parallels? And secondly, what significance do the parallels have? When you examine things like the Enuma Elish and Genesis 1, you find an enormous amount of overlap. There's an article by Peter Enns on BioLogos that talks about that. I can't remember the name of it, but you could just search for the key terms on the BioLogos website. I think the author of Genesis 1 is doing a lot. I think Genesis 1 is extremely packed. I think it's extremely dense theologically. The author is just doing a bunch of things. And when it comes to, like, examining other ancient Near Eastern creation myths like Enuma Elish, the Ugaritic material, Atrahasis, whether or not you think that these are strained, it really depends on like what how if they only have like one or two things in common, like they both have a god that creates, right? Well, that's not too much of a parallel. But when the similarities start to really add up, then you start to think, well, one is interacting with the other in some way. You know, atheists will say, oh, the Bible is plagiarizing the Ugaritic material. It's plagiarizing the Epic of Gilgamesh. I don't think that's true. I think the author is interacting with them. He's polemicizing them. That was the way the prophets did apologetics. It was basically, my God can beat up your God. Anything your God can do, my God can do better. You think your God is the rider of the clouds? No, Yahweh is the rider of the clouds. Your God is the one that defeated the chaos dragon and built the world out of that? No, Yahweh is the one who crushed the heads of Leviathan, not Marduk, not Baal. That's what they're doing. That's why you find these similarities. They were trying to get the Israelites to see that Yahweh is supreme, and anything that is said about these other gods, Yahweh is the one that did it. So I don't really find that critique of John Walton and A&E Parallels is really that good. In order to really have legs, you would have to show that there's just far too many different the differences just outweigh the similarities. You would have to show that it's like some of the really strained parallels between, say, Jesus and Mithras. It would have to be something like that in order for it to be a legit criticism. So that's all that we have. Oh, that's right. I don't work on Monday night. So I will probably, probably, nah, I probably, I don't know. Do you guys want me to do another stream this soon or wait until next week? I may not be off Monday night next week, but most people seem to be available Mondays than any other days. I'll have to think about it. Well, whether you tuned in live or whether you tuned in or whether you're watching it on playback later, thank you for watching Cerebral Faith Live. Or if you're listening to the audio podcast on Stitcher or Spotify, thank you for listening. And again, if you want more content like this, not only in video or audio form, but there's also a lot of written material I've put out, check out cerebralfaith.net. And if you'd like to support this ministry, go to patreon.com/cerebralfaith. Oh, and by the way, Cerebral Faith will be turning 10 years old this year. I started this as just a simple blogger blog back in August of 2012. I was 20. And I don't know exactly what I'm going to do for a 10th anniversary special. I'd like to have some kind of special live stream. I don't know what I can do. But I will think about it. I want to do something because it's the 10th anniversary. Maybe you guys can have some ideas for me and put them in the comment section below. Thank you for watching, and oh, by the way, hold on a sec. Yes, I accept cookies. I never say no to cookies. Shout outs to my patrons, Red Blade Flame, Steel Cat, Andrew Melnick, Nathan Hamilton, Jordan Hampton, Brandon Whitaker, and David Parrish. Peace out, God bless, and keep using the brains that God gave you.